This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and happy Memorial Day to you. We want to start today with a few simple questions. When did Americans first observe Memorial Day, and why? Well, the answer to both questions is as profoundly moving a story as you'll ever hear. And it begins on a racetrack in Charleston, South Carolina in 1865. Yale historian David Blight uncovered that forgotten, or in some cases willfully suppressed, history of Memorial Day.
It was born in the midst of the Civil War in all sorts of visits by principally women and families to battlefields trying to find their dead loved ones, and sometimes marking graves whether they found their actual loved ones or not. That kind of general ritual culminated at the end of the war in more formal rituals. The first, so far as we know, at least in time, happened in Charleston, South Carolina on May 1st, 1865. A huge parade and burial ritual conducted by African-American former slaves.
So tell us more about that. I mean, that's the part of this history which I think is not well enough known, that it's African-American former slaves who really brought the tradition into, is it fair to call it, like in more into the mainstream?
Well, it wasn't mainstream yet because it will eventually be suppressed and forgotten. But what happened was, in brief, this. Charleston, where the Civil War, of course, began at Fort Sumter, was evacuated finally in the very last month or two of the war. The people left in the city were largely African-American, former slaves, and then Union troops. The Confederates had converted the Lowcountry Planters' horse track into an outdoor prison. And some 260-odd Union soldiers had died of exposure and disease in the infield of that prison and had been buried in a mass grave behind the grandstand. The black folk of Charleston, largely, with some aid of Union troops, got organized. They reburied those 268, we believe, Union soldiers, virtually all without names, of course, because there were no dog tags in that war. And on May 1st, 1865, they held a parade on the track of the old race course of approximately 10,000 people, led by blacks. Actually, groups of women led the parade, then men, then children, then Union soldiers, Union troops, both black and white, and we even know which Union units were there. In fact, the 54th Massachusetts,
the first,
left of it.
Yeah, the all-black, the first all-black military unit, right.
The first, the great unit recruited, of course, in Massachusetts. They marched around the race course carrying armloads of all kinds of flowers. They then gathered as many as could fit into the compound of this cemetery they had created. There were five black ministers who preached or read from scripture at this ceremony. There was a small black children's choir that sang America the Beautiful, the Star-Spangled Banner, Rally Around the Flag, and some spirituals. And then they did what most of us do on Memorial Day. They all went back into the infield where the prison had been. They had picnics. The children ran races. They had a platform where supposedly 15 or 16 speeches were made. And the troops marched and drilled. And in effect, that is the first full-scale practice of what we've come to know as Decoration Day, or we call Memorial Day. It was May 1st, 1865. What people can hopefully read or see in that is that this was African-American former slaves and their Union soldier allies declaring their meaning of that war. They were taking over the planters, the slaveholders' racetrack, and nothing had been more important and symbolic to the Lowcountry Planters of Carolina than their horse track. The idea that they were marching on that track now with flowers to commemorate the Union dead was, in effect, their way of declaring a kind of Independence Day, a new Independence Day of their freedom.
It feels so profoundly moving to hear this story today, that what we mark as Memorial Day today actually comes from the tradition and actions of formerly enslaved people, as you said. I feel very moved just hearing this story, but how was it viewed at the time?
Well, it was viewed as profound by those who witnessed it. And by the way, I found this in a very obscure collection of old veterans' materials in the Harvard libraries, and I actually found the first description of this on a piece of cardboard, handwritten, probably by an old veteran, but it turns out he was copying that out of an article from the New York Herald Tribune. Then I began to find other sources. Harper's Weekly even had a lithograph of the Gray site by 1867 and so on. It appears, the story appears in some diaries and memoirs as well. So anyone who witnessed this or participated in it could, of course, never forgotten it. But what happened in rough terms is that this kind of event eventually, especially in South Carolina, across the South, lost out to a broader official Confederate lost cause tradition or memory, which wanted nothing to do with this kind of story.
Right. So it sounds as if very quickly after 1865, the link to the fact that it was formerly enslaved people who were marking the sacrifice of the Union dead, that link got lost pretty quickly.
It did, but here's an interesting little fact that I found in the research. Along about 1903, so 40 years after this, a woman from the United Daughters of the Confederacy in New Orleans, of all places, writes to her counterpart, this woman in South Carolina, and says, you know, we've heard this story about a big parade on the race course in Charleston at the end of the war in the spring of 65, led by the former slaves. And she says, do you know anything of that story? It's a letter. And the woman from South Carolina writes back and says simply, of that story, we know nothing. Now, she may have been telling the truth that she knew nothing of it. She may have also heard of it and, of course, didn't want to remember it. But it tells us a lot. This kind of story tells us a great deal about how historical memories are born, grow, and sometimes lose out or get suppressed in this marketplace of the struggle over the politics of memory. And nothing has ever been more divisive and more vexing and troublesome for Americans than the memory of that Civil War.
Oh, yes. And I want to ask you about that a little more in just a moment. But I am curious, how did the practice of what then, as you said, a couple of years later became called Decoration Day, how did that practice then become so widespread across the country?
In the North, it was officially designated, we should say, in 1868. By the leader of the Grand Army of the Republic. That's the major Union veterans organization that was just taking root. His name was John Logan, former Union general. And it was put out as a call to all communities across the nation, in this case, the North largely. And in 68 and 69 and up to the early 70s, hundreds of towns all across the North, especially and the border states, would exercise these rituals. They would generally be, in those years, a massive parade, often from the center of a town, depending on how big the town was, to a cemetery, often with representative children representing orphans, and very often they were orphans, often with lines of little girls in white dresses, representing that old ancient notion of purity and you know how the soldiers fought to save the women. And then they would go to cemeteries. There would be the commemorative Decoration Day speech. They would decorate the graves with flowers. There would be prayers. Other than the 4th of July, it became the American ritual practice of not just commemorating the dead, but it became a day on which the war itself was commemorated. And eventually, with time, It became a day that speechmakers and editorial writers and essay writers would not just commemorate the Union dead, but it became eventually a kind of ritual also of sectional and national reconciliation.
Mm. Well, I'm thinking how striking hearing this history is today, because as you said earlier, there has been this long-term battle in America over the historical memory that we all have of the Civil War. And in fact, I think it was, what, last year that you wrote an article in The Atlantic where you said, you wrote something to the effect of that not only is the Civil War not over, but it can still be lost. What did you mean by that?
Well, that did sound a little bold, I'm sure. But what I meant by that is that the extended great issues over which the Union divided and the country went to war and we sacrificed on a scale we've never experienced since, the great issues of that war are still with us, and largely two. One, of course, is race, our ongoing, probably eternal struggle. And all we need to do is look around today with one eye open, and we see that we still have enormous problems of inequality. We have enormous problems with racial division, and we have politicians who will exploit those racial divisions. The other great issue of the Civil War, which sometimes gets a little lost in our public debate, is states' rights, states' rights doctrine. I mean, federalism is inherent to our constitutional system. It's inherent to American jurisprudence in the courts. But good Lord, if we have the other eye open, just look. States' rights doctrine has been undergoing a huge revival in the last 30, 40 years in the Supreme Court, in the Republican Party. It now basically controls 35 state legislatures and the vast majority of governor's offices. But every time we think we've put a certain degree of the worst elements of states' rights doctrine to rest, it always revives. Always revives. So as long as this country fights that struggle over states' rights and over race in particular, in a sense, our Civil War is still with us in ideological forms and in our political discourse. Legacies come in many forms, and they often shock us and surprise us, and we wonder where in the world they came from. And that's, in effect, why we do history.
Yeah. Well, and they can also inspire us and move us, because I'm still thinking, I have the image in my head of what you described, those black women and black ministers and little children who had been enslaved marching in South Carolina to honor all that was lost or all that was sacrificed by the Union in the Civil War. And can I just ask you, my final question is, with that story in mind, I mean, as we mark this Memorial Day this year, what do you hope people take from hearing this history?
Well, for one thing, I hope they take that our prolonged, seemingly never-ending debate over just what the role of slavery was in the causes, the course, and the consequences of the Civil War, just look at that event. If people could just read the piece, for example, I did in the New York Times about whatever it was 5 years ago about this particular event in Charleston, no one can understand what happened there on the race course that day in Charleston and not understand that that war was all about slavery. What were those people saying with their marching feet, their armloads of roses, their songs as tributes to the Union dead? They were saying that had been a horrifying, bloody, god-awful struggle for their freedom and therefore for the enlarging freedom of the rest of American society.
Well, we have a link to your New York Times opinion piece. We'll put it at our website. It's radioboston.org. David Blight is a professor of history and director of the Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale. Professor Blight, it's been such an honor. Thank you so very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Magna. I enjoyed it.
There's more ahead. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.